a path, splendid and stately in its gold and silver harness, towering in calm disdain above a crowd of gawking spectators, strikingly exotic and utterly out of place among the formalized white statues. "Yes," I said, though with a reluctance that squeezed my heart. "Yes, of course she'll have to go back. She belongs there."
"I ken that well enough."
He put his own hand over mine, but kept his face turned away, looking at Brianna.
"I shouldn't grieve for it, but I do."
"So do I." I put my forehead against his shoulder, breathing in the clean male scent of him.
"It's true, though, what I said. You can't truly lose a child."
Do you remember Faith?"
My voice trembled slightly as I asked it. We hadn't spoken in years of our first daughter, stillborn in France.
His arm curled around me, pulling me against him.
"Of course I do," he said softly. "Do you think I would ever forget?"
"No." The tears were flowing down my face, but I wasn't truly weeping. It was no more than the overflow of feeling. "That's what I mean. I never told you. When we were in Paris to see Jared, I went to the Hôpital des Anges. I saw her grave there. I brought her a pink tulip." He was quiet for a moment.
"I took her violets," he said,
so softly I almost didn't hear him. I was quite still for a moment, tears forgotten.
"You didn't tell me."
"Neither did you."
His fingers traced the bumps of my spine, brushing softly up and down the line of my back.
"I was afraid you'd feel..."
My voice trailed off. I'd been afraid he would feel guilty, worry that I blamed him. I once had, for the loss. We were newly reunited then. I had no wish to jeopardize the tender link between us.
"So was I."
"I'm sorry that you never saw her," I said at last, and felt him sigh. He turned toward me and put his arms around me, his lips brushing my forehead.
"It doesn't matter, does it?"
"Aye, it's true what you say, Sassenach. She was, and we will have her, always. And Brianna, if, when she goes, she will still be with us."
"Yes, it doesn't matter what happens, no matter where a child goes, how far or how long, even if it's forever. You never lose them. You can't." He didn't answer, but his arms tightened round me, and he sighed once more. The breeze stirred the air above us with the sound of angels' wings, and we fell slowly asleep together as the moonlight bathed us in its ageless peace. Chapter 43. Whiskey in the Jar.
I didn't like Ronnie Sinclair. I never had liked him. I didn't like his half-handsome face, his foxy smile, or the way his eyes met mine, so direct, so openly honest, that you knew he was hiding something even when he wasn't. I particularly didn't like the way he was looking at my daughter.
I cleared my throat loudly, making him jump. He turned a sharp-toothed smile on me, idly turning a truss ring in his hands.
"Jamie says he'll need a dozen more of the small whiskey casks by the end of the month, and I'll need a large barrel of hickory wood for the smoked meat, as soon as you can manage."
He nodded, and made a number of cryptic marks on a slab of pine that hung on the wall. Oddly, for a Scot, Sinclair couldn't write, but had some sort of private shorthand that enabled him to keep track of orders and accounts.
"Right, Mrs. Fraser. Anything else?"
I paused, trying to reckon up all the possible necessities for cooperage that might spring up before snowfall. There would be fish and meat to salt down, but those did better in stoneware jars. Wooden casks left them tasting of turpentine. I had a good seasoned barrel for apples and another for squash already. The potatoes would be stored on shelves to keep from rotting.
"No," I decided. "That will be all." "Aye, missus."
He hesitated, twirling the cask band faster.
"'Will himself be coming down before the casks are ready?' "'No. He has the barley to get in and the slaughtering to do, as well as the distilling. Everything's late because of the trial.' I raised an eyebrow at him. "'Why, though? Do you have a message for him?'
Sited at the foot of the cove, nearest the wagon road, the cooper's shop was the first building most visitors encountered, and thus a reception point for most gossip that came from outside Fraser's Ridge. Sinclair tilted his gingery head, considering,
"'Oh, it's likely it's nothing. Only I've heard of a stranger in the district asking questions about Jimmy Fraser.'
From the corner of my eye I saw Brianna's head snap round, distracted at once from her inspection of the spokeshavers, mallets, saws and axes on the wall. She turned, skirt rustling in the wood shavings that littered the shop, ankle deep.
"'Do you know the stranger's name?' she asked anxiously. "'Or what he looks like?'
Sinclair shot her a look of surprise. He was oddly proportioned, with slender shoulders but muscular arms, and hands so huge that they might have belonged to a man twice his height. He looked at her, and his broad thumb unconsciously stroked the metal of the ring slowly, over and over again.
"'Why, I couldn't speak to his appearance, mistress,' he said, politely enough, but with a hungry look in his eyes that made me want to take the truss ring away from him and wrap it round his neck. "'He gave his name as Hodgepile, though.'
Brianna's face lost its look of hope, though the muscle at the edge of her mouth curved slightly at the name.
"'I don't suppose that could be Roger,' she murmured to me. "'Likely not,' I agreed. "'He wouldn't have any reason to use a false name, anyway.'
I turned back to Sinclair.
"'You won't have heard of a man called Wakefield, will you? Roger Wakefield?'
Sinclair shook his head decisively.
"'No, missus. Himself has put word about that if such a one should come, he's to be taken to the ridge at once. If yon Wakefield sets foot within the county, you'll hear of it as soon as I do.'
Brianna sighed, and I heard her swallow her disappointment. It was mid-October, and while she said nothing, she was clearly growing more anxious by the day. She wasn't the only one, either. She had told us what Roger was trying to do, and the thought of the variety of disasters that might have befallen him in the attempt was enough to keep me wakeful at night.
"'How about the whisky?'
Sinclair was saying, jerking my attention back to him.
"'The whisky?'
Hodgepile was asking about Jamie and whisky? Sinclair nodded and set down the truss ring.
"'In Cross Creek, no one would say a word to him, of course, but the one who told me did say as the one who spoke to the man thought him a soldier.'
He grimaced briefly.
"'Hard for a lobster back to wash the flour from his hair.' "'He wasn't dressed as a soldier, surely?'
Foot soldiers wore their hair in a tight-folded queue, wrapped round a core of lamb's wool, and powdered with rice flour, which in this climate rapidly turned to paste as the flour mixed with sweat. Still, I imagine Sinclair meant the man's attitude rather than his appearance.'
"'Oh, no, he did claim to be a fur trader, but he walked wi' a ramrod up his arse, and you could hear the leather creak where he talked. So Georgie McClintock said.
"'Likely one of Murchison's men. I'll tell Jamie. Thank you.' I left the cooper's shop with Brianna, wondering just how much trouble this Hodgepile might prove to be. Likely not much. The sheer distance from civilization and the inaccessibility of the ridge was protection against most intrusions, one of Jamie's purposes in choosing it. The multiple inconveniences of remoteness would be outweighed by its benefits when it came to war. No battle would be fought on Fraser's Ridge, I was sure of that. And no matter how virulent Murchison's grudge might be, or how good his spies, I couldn't see his superiors allowing him to mount an armed expedition more than 100 miles into the mountains for the sole purpose of extirpating an illegal distillery whose total output was less than 100 gallons a year. Lizzie and Ian were waiting for us outside, occupied in gathering kindling from Sinclair's rubbish heap. A cooper's work generated immense quantities of shavings, splinters, and discarded chunks of wood and bark, and it was worth the labour of picking them up to save splitting kindling by hand at home.
"Can you and Ian load the barrels, honey?" I asked Brianna. "I want to look at Lizzie in the sunlight."
Brianna nodded, still looking abstracted, and went to help Ian heave the half-dozen small kegs outside the shop into the wagon. They were small, but heavy. It was the skill that went into these particular barrels that had earned Ronnie Sinclair his land and shop, in spite of his less-than-prepossessing personality. Not every cooper knew the trick of charring the inside of an oak barrel so as to lend a beautiful amber colour and deep smoky flavour to the whisky aging gently inside.
"Come here, sweetie. Let me see your eyes."
Lizzie obediently widened her eyes and let me pull down the lower lid to see the white sclera of the eyeball. The girl was still shockingly thin, but the nasty yellow tinge of jaundice was fading from her skin and her eyes were nearly white again. I cupped my fingers gently under her jaw, lymph glands only slightly swollen. That was better, too.
"Feeling all right?" I asked.
She smiled shyly and nodded. It was the first time she'd been outside the cabin since her arrival with Ian 3 weeks before. She was still wobbly as a new calf. Frequent infusions of Jesuit bark had helped, though. She had had no fresh attacks of fever in the last week, and I had hopes of clearing up the liver involvement in short order.
"Mrs. Fraser," she said,
and I jumped, startled to hear her talk. She was so shy that she could seldom bring herself to say anything to me, or to Jamie directly. She murmured her needs to Brianna, who conveyed them to me.
"Yes, dear. I couldn't help hearing what Jan Cooper said about how Mr. Fraser's asked word of Miss Brianna's man. I did wonder."
Her words trailed off in a spasm of shyness, and a faint rose-pink blush showed in her transparent cheeks.
"Yes. Could he ask for my father, do you think?"
The words came out in a rush, and she blushed still harder.
"Oh, Lizzie, I'm sorry."
Brianna, finished with the barrels, came and hugged her little maid.
"I hadn't forgotten, but I hadn't thought either. Just a minute. I'll go and tell Mr. Sinclair."
With a whiff of skirts, she vanished into the cool dimness of the cooper's shop.
"Your father?" I asked. "Have you lost him?"
A girl nodded, pressing her lips together to prevent their quivering.
"He'll have gone as a bondsman, but I dinna ken where. Only it would be to the southern colonies."
Well, that limited the search to several hundred thousand square miles, I thought. Still, it could do no harm to ask Ronnie Sinclair to put out word. Newspapers and other printed matter were scarce in the South. Most real news still passed by word of mouth, handed on in shops and taverns, or carried by slaves and servants between far-flung plantations. The thought of newspapers gave me a small, nasty jolt of remembrance. Still, 7 years seemed comfortingly far away, and Brianna must be right. Whether the house was doomed to burn on January the 21st or not, surely it would be possible for us not to be in it on that date. Brianna appeared, rather red in the face, swung aboard the wagon and picked up the reins, waiting impatiently for the rest of us. Ian, seeing her flushed face, frowned and glanced toward the cooper's shop.
"What is it, cuz? Did yon wee manny say aught amiss to you?"
He flexed his hands, nearly as large as Sinclair's.
"No," she said tersely, "not a word. Are we ready to go?"
Ian picked Lizzie up and swung her into the wagon bed, then put out a hand and helped me up on the seat by Brianna. He glanced at the reins in Brianna's hands. He had taught her to drive the mules and took professional pride in her skill.
"Watch the bugger on the G side," he advised her. "He'll no be pulling his share of the load, unless you touch him up now and again with a slap across the rump."
He subsided into the wagon bed with Lizzie as we set off up the road. I could hear him telling her outlandish stories and her faint giggle in reply. The baby of his own family, Ian was charmed by Lizzie and treated her like a younger sister, by turns nuisance and pet. I glanced over my shoulder at the receding cooper's shop, then at Brianna. "What did he do?" I asked quietly.
"Nothing." I interrupted him.
The flush across her wide cheekbones grew deeper.
"What on earth was he doing?"
"Drawing pictures on a piece of wood," she said, and bit the inside of her cheek.
"Of naked women?"
I laughed, as much from shock as from amusement.
"Well, he hasn't got a wife, and not likely to get one soon. Women are very scarce in the colony generally, and even more so up here. I suppose one can't blame him."
I felt an unexpected pang of sympathy for Ronnie Sinclair. He'd been alone for a very long time, after all. His wife had died in the terrible days after Culloden, and he himself had spent more than 10 years in prison before being transported to the colonies. If he had made connections here, they hadn't endured. He was a solitary man, and suddenly I saw his avid questing for gossip, his stealthy watching,
even his use of Brianna for artistic inspiration, in a different light.
I knew what it was like to be lonely.
Brianna's embarrassment had faded, and she was whistling softly under her breath, hunched casually over the reins.
A Beatles tune, I thought, though I never could keep pop groups straight.
The idle thought floated insidiously through my mind. If Roger didn't come, she wouldn't be left alone for long, either here or when she returned to the future. But that was ridiculous. He would come, and if not...
A thought I'd been trying to keep at bay sneaked past my defences and appeared in my mind full-blown.
What if he had chosen not to come?
I knew they had had some sort of argument, though Brianna had been tight-lipped about it. Had he been so infuriated that he would go back without her? I rather thought the possibility had occurred to her too. She had stopped speaking much of Roger, but I saw the anxious light spring up in her eyes whenever Clarence announced a visitor, and saw it die each time the visitor proved to be one of Jamie's tenants or some of Ian's Tuscaroran friends.
"Hurry up, you blighter," I muttered under my breath.
Brianna caught it and smartly snapped the reins over the left mule's rump.
"Gee up,"
she shouted, and the wagon rattled faster, jolting over the narrow track toward home.
"It's a far cry from the still cellar at Leoch,"
Jamie said, ruefully poking at the makeshift pot still at the edge of the small clearing.
"It does make whiskey, though, of a sort."
In spite of his diffidence, Brianna could see that he was proud of his infant distillery. It was nearly 2 miles from the cabin, located, as he explained, close to Fergus's place, so that Marsali could come up several times a day to keep an eye on the operation. In return for this service, she and Fergus had a slightly larger share in the resulting whisky than did the other farmers on the ridge, who supplied the raw barley and helped in the distribution of the liquor.
"No, darling, you dinna want to be eating that nasty wee thing," Marsali said firmly.
She grasped her son's wrist and began prying open his fingers one by one in an effort to free the large and madly wriggling insect that, in open contradiction of his mother's adjuration, he very obviously did want to be eating.
"Seh!"
Marsali dropped the cockroach on the ground and stamped on it. Germaine, a stoic, stubby child, didn't cry at the loss of his treat, but glowered balefully under his blonde fringe. The cockroach, nothing daunted by rough treatment, rose out of the leaf mould and walked off, staggering only slightly.
"Oh, I shouldn't have think it would do him harm," Ian said, amused. "I've eaten them, now and again, we the Indians. The locusts are bitter, though, especially the smoked ones."
Marsali and Brianna both made gagging noises, causing Ian to grin even wider. He picked up another bag of barley and poured a thick layer into a flat rush basket. 2 more roaches, suddenly exposed to the light of day, skittered madly over the side of the basket, fell to the ground, and dashed away, disappearing under the edge of the crudely built malting floor.
"No," I said.
Marsali kept a tight hold on Germaine's collar, preventing his determined attempts to follow them.
"Stay, you wee fiend. Do you want to be smoked too?"
Small wisps of transparent smoke rose up through the cracks of the wooden platform, permeating the small clearing with the breakfast-like scent of roasting grain. Brianna felt her stomach gurgle. It was nearly supper-time.
"Maybe you should leave them in," she suggested, joking. "Smoked roaches might add a nice flavour to the whisky."
"I doubt they'd harm it any," her father agreed, coming up beside her.
He wiped his face with a handkerchief, looked at it, and made a slight face at the sooty smudges on it before tucking it back up his sleeve.
"All right, Ian."
"Aye, it'll do. It's only the one bag that's spoilt all through, Uncle Jimmy."
Ian rose with his tray of raw barley and kicked negligently at a split bag where the soft green of mould and black tinge of rot showed the ill effects of seeping damp. Two more open bags, with the spoiled top layer scooped off, sat by the edge of the malting floor.
"Let's finish, then," Jamie said. "I'm starved."
He and Ian each seized a burlap bag and scattered the fresh barley in a thick layer over the clear space on the platform, using a flat wooden spade to flatten and turn the grain.
"How long does it all take?"
Brianna poked her nose over the edge of the mash tub, where Masali was stirring the fermenting grain of the last smoking. The mash had only begun to work. There was no more than a faint whiff of alcohol in the air.
"Oh, it will depend on the weather a bit."
Masali cast an experienced eye skyward. It was late afternoon, and the sky had begun to darken into a clear, deep blue, with no more than streaks of white cloud floating over the horizon.
"Clear as it is, I should say..."
"Jermaine!"
Jermaine's bottom was the only part of him visible, the top half having disappeared under a log.
"I'll get him."
Brianna took three quick strides across the clearing and scooped him up. Jermaine made a deep sound of protest at this unwarranted interference and began to kick, hammering his sturdy heels against her legs.
"How?"
Brianna set him on the ground, rubbing her thigh with one hand. Masali made a sound of exasperation and dropped her ladle.
"No, what have you got, you wicked thing?"
Jermaine, having learned from experience, popped his latest acquisition into his mouth and swallowed convulsively. He immediately turned purple and began to choke. With a cry of alarm, Masali dropped to her knees and tried to pry his mouth open. Jermaine gagged, wheezed, and staggered backwards, shaking his head. His blue eyes bulged, and a thin line of drool snaked down his chin.
"Here."
Brianna grabbed the little boy by the arm, pulled his back against her, and with both hands fisted into his stomach, jerked them sharply back. Jermaine made a loud whooping noise, and something small and round shot out of his mouth. He gurgled, gasped for air, got a good lungful, and started to howl, his face going from dusky purple to a healthy red within seconds.
"Is he all right?"
Jamie peered anxiously at the little boy, who was crying in his mother's arms, then, satisfied, glanced at Brianna.
"That was very quick, lass. A good job."
"Thanks.
Thanks. I'm glad it worked." Brianna felt a little shaky. Seconds. It hadn't taken more than a few seconds. Life to death, and back again, in nothing flat. Jamie touched her arm, giving her a brief squeeze, and she felt a little better.
"Best take the laddie down to the house," he told Masali. "Give him his supper, and put him to bed. We'll finish here."
Masali nodded, looking shaken herself. She brushed a strand of pale hair out of her eyes, and gave Brianna a poor attempt at a smile.
"Thank you, good sister."
Brianna felt a surprising small glow of pleasure at the title. She gave Masali back the smile.
"I'm glad he's all right."
Masali picked up her bag from the ground, and with a nod to Jamie, turned and made her way carefully down the steep path, toddler in her arms, Jermaine's chubby fists twined tightly in her hair.
"That was pretty work, cuz."
Ian had finished the spreading and jumped down from the platform to congratulate her.
"Where did you learn a thing like that?"
"From my mother."
Ian nodded, looking impressed. Jamie bent over, searching the ground nearby.
"What was it the lad swallowed, I wonder?"
"This."
Brianna spotted the object, half buried under fallen leaves, and plucked it out.
"It looks like a button."
The object was a lopsided circle, crudely carved from wood, but indisputably a button. with a long shank and holes bored for thread.
Let me see.
Jamie held out a hand, and she dropped the button into it.
You'll no be missing any buttons, will you, Ian?
He asked, frowning at the small object in his palm.
Ian peered over Jamie's shoulder and shook his head.
Maybe Fergus? He suggested.
Maybe, but I dunno think so. Our Fergus is too much the dandy to be wearing something like this. All the buttons on his coat are made of polished horn.
He shook his head slowly, still frowning, then shrugged. Picking up his spollen, he put the button into it before fastening it about his waist.
Ah, well, I'll ask about. Will you finish here, Ian? There's no much left to do.
He smiled at Brianna and cocked his head toward the path.
Come then, lass. We'll ask at Lindsay's on our way home.
In the event, Kenny Lindsay wasn't at home.
"Duncan Ennis came to fetch him not an hour since," Mrs. Lindsay said, shading her eyes against the late sun as she stood in the doorway of her house. "I make nae doot they'll be to your house the noo. Will ye and your lassie no step in, MacDoo, and have a taste of something?"
"Ah, no, thank you, Mrs. Kinney. My wife will be having the supper ready for us. But perhaps you could be telling me whether this wee bawbee is from Kenny's coat."
Mrs. Lindsay peered at the button in his hand, then shook her head.
"No, indeed. Have I not just finished sewing on a whole fresh set of buttons for him that he's carved from the bone of a deer? The bonniest things you ever saw, too," she declared, with pride in her husband's craftsmanship. "Each one has got a wee face on it, grinning like an imp, and each one different."
Her eye ran speculatively over Brianna.
"There's Kenny's brother now," she said, "with a fine wee place near Cross Creek. 20 acres in tobacco, and a good creek through it. He'll be at the gathering at Mount Helicon. Perhaps you'll be going, MacDoo?"
Jamie shook his head, smiling at the bald hint. There were few available women in the colony, and even though Jamie had given it out that Brianna was promised elsewhere, this hadn't by any means put a stop to the matchmaking attempts.
"I fear not this year, Mrs. Kenny. Perhaps the next, but I cannot spare the time just now."
They took their leave politely and turned toward home, the sinking sun at their backs casting long shadows on the path ahead of them. "Do you think the button's important?" Brianna asked curiously. Jamie shrugged slightly. A light breeze lifted the hair on the crown of his head and tugged at the leather thong that held it back.
"I cannot see. It could be nothing, but it could be something too. Your mother told me what Ronnie Sinclair said about the man in Cross Creek asking about the whiskey."
"Hodgepile?" Brianna couldn't help smiling at the name. Jamie returned the smile briefly, then became serious again.
"Aye. If the button belongs to someone on the ridge, they ken well enough where the still is, and they might stop to look and no harm done. But if it was to be a stranger..."
He glanced at her and shrugged again.
"It's none so easy for a man to pass unnoticed here, unless he should be hiding a purpose. A man come for any innocent reason would stop at the house for a bit of food and drink, and I'd hear of it the same day. But there's been nothing of the sort. Nor would it be an Indian. They dinna use such things in their clothing."
A gust of wind whirred across the path in a swirl of brown and yellow leaves, and they turned uphill toward the cabin. They walked in near silence, affected by the growing quiet of the woods. The birds were still singing twilight songs, but the shadows were lengthening under the trees. The northern slope of the mountain across the valley had already gone dark and silent, as the sun edged behind it. The cabin's clearing was still filled with sunlight, though, filtered through a yellow blaze of chestnut trees. Claire was in the palisaded garden, a basin on one hip, snapping beans from poled vines. Her slender figure was silhouetted dark against the sun, her hair a great aureole of curly gold.
"Innisfree,"
Brianna said involuntarily, stopping dead at the sight.
"Innisfree?"
Jamie glanced at her, bewildered. She hesitated, but there was no way out of explaining.
"It's a poem, or part of one.
Daddy always used to say it when he'd come home and find Mama puttering in her garden. He said she'd live out there if she could. He used to joke that she'd leave us some day and go find a place where she could live by herself with nothing but her plants.
Ah.
Jamie's face was calm, its broad plains ruddy in the dying light.
How does the poem go, then?
She was conscious of a small tightness round her heart as she said it.
I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there, of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade.
The thick red brows drew together slightly, sparkling in the sun.
A poem, is it? And where is Innisfree?
Ireland, maybe? He was Irish, Brianna said in explanation.
The poet.
The row of bee gums stood squat on their stones at the edge of the wood.
Oh.
Tiny motes of gold and black drifted past them through the honeyed air, bees homing from the fields. Her father made no move to go forward, but stood silent by her side, watching her mother pick beans, black and gold among the leaves.
Not alone, after all, she thought.
But the small tightness stayed in her chest, not quite an ache. Kenny Lindsay took a sip of whiskey, closed his eyes, and rolled the liquor round his tongue like a professional wine taster. He paused, frowning in concentration, then swallowed with a convulsive gulp.
Whew!
He drew breath, shuddering all over.
Christ! He said hoarsely. That'll strip your tripes.
Jamie grinned at the compliment and poured another small measure, shoving it toward Duncan.
Aye, it's better than the last, he agreed, with a cautious sniff before essaying his own drink. This one doesn't take the hide off your tongue, quite.
Lindsay wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, nodding in agreement.
Well, it'll find a good home. Woolham wants a cask. That'll last him a year, the way yon Quakers dole it out. You've agreed a price?
Lindsay nodded, sniffing appreciatively at the platter of bannocks and savouries that Lizzie set in front of him.
100 weight of barley for the cask, another if you'll go halves with him and the whisky from it. That's fair.
Jamie took a bannock and chewed it absently for a moment. Then he raised one brow at Duncan, seated across the table.
Will you ask MacLeod on Naylor's Creek? Will he make us the same bargain? You'll pass that way going home, aye?
Duncan nodded, chewing, and Jamie lifted his cup to me in a silent toast of celebration. Woolham's offer made a total of 800 pounds of barley, scraped together by barter and promise. More than the surplus output of every field on the ridge, the raw material for next year's whisky.
A cask each to the houses on the ridge, 2 to Fergus.
Jamie pulled absently at his earlobe, calculating.
2 maybe to Nacognowito. 1 kept back to age. Aye, we can spare maybe 12 casks for the gathering, Duncan.
Duncan's coming was opportune. While Jamie had managed to barter the first year's crop of raw whisky to the Moravians in Salem for the tools, cloth, and other things we so urgently needed, there was no doubt that the wealthy Scottish planters of the Cape Fear would make a better market. We couldn't possibly spare time away from the homestead for long enough to make the week-long journey to Mount Helicon, but if Duncan could take the whisky down and sell it... I was already making lists in my head. Everyone brought things to sell at a gathering. Wool, cloth, tools, food, animals. I urgently needed a small copper kettle and 6 lengths of fresh muslin for shifts and...
Do you think you should give alcohol to the Indians?
Brianna's question pulled me from my greedy reverie.
Why not? Lindsay asked, a little disapproving of her intrusion. After all, we're no going to give it to them, lass. They've little silver, but they pay in hides, and they pay well.
Brianna glanced at me for support, then at Jamie. But Indians don't... I mean, I've heard that they can't handle alcohol. All three men looked at her, uncomprehendingly, And Duncan looked at his cup, turning it round in his hand.
Handle it?
The corner of her mouth quirked inward.
They get drunk easily, I mean.
Lindsay peered into his cup, then looked at her, rubbing a hand over the balding crown of his head.
You've a point, lass,
he said, more or less politely. Brianna's full mouth compressed itself, then relaxed.
I mean, she said, it seems wrong to encourage people to drink who can't stop drinking if they start.
She looked at me a little helplessly. I shook my head.
Alcoholic isn't a noun yet, I said. It's not a disease now, just weak character.
Jamie glanced up at her quizzically.
Well, I'll tell you, lass, he said. I've seen many a drunkard in my day, but I've yet to see a bottle leap off a table and pour itself down anyone's throat.
There were general grunts of agreement with this, and another small round to accompany the change of subject.
Hodgepyle? No, I've not seen the man, though I do believe I've heard the name.
Duncan swilled the rest of his drink and set down his cup, wheezing gently.
You'll want me to ask at the gathering.
Jamie nodded and took another bannock.
Aye, if you will, Duncan.
Lizzie was bent over the fire, stirring the stew for supper. I saw her shoulders tighten, but she was too shy to speak before so many men. Brianna suffered no such inhibitions.
I have someone to ask after too, Mr. Innes.
She leaned over the table toward him, eyes fixed on him in earnest entreaty.
Will you ask for a man named Roger Wakefield? Please?
Och, indeed, indeed I will.
Duncan went pink at the proximity of Brianna's bosom, and in confusion drank down the rest of Kenny's whisky.
Is there aught else I can do?
Yes, I said, putting down a fresh cup in front of the disgruntled Lindsay. While you're asking after Hodgepyle and Breeze, young man, would you also ask for a man named Joseph Weems? He'll be a bondsman. From the corner of my eye I saw Lizzie's thin shoulders slump in relief. Duncan nodded, his composure restored as Brianna disappeared into the pantry to fetch butter. Kenny Lindsay looked after her, interested.
"Bree, is that the name you call your daughter?"
he asked.
"Yes,"
I said.
"Why?"
A smile showed briefly on Lindsay's face. Then he glanced at Jamie, coughed, and buried the smile in his cup.
"It's a Scots word, Sassenach,"
Jamie said, a rather wry smile appearing on his own face.
"A bree is a great disturbance."
Chapter 44. Three-Cornered Conversation. October 1769. The shock of impact juddered through his arms. With a rhythm born of long practice, Jamie jerked the axe head free, swung it back, and brought it down in a thunk of splintered bark and yellow wood chips. He shifted his foot on the log and struck again, the axe blow judged to a nicety, sharp metal embedded in the wood a scant 2 inches from his toes. He could have told Ian to do the chopping, and gone himself to fetch the fowl from the tiny mill at Woolham's Point, but the lad deserved the treat of a visit with the 3 unmarried Woolham daughters who worked with their father in the mill. They were Quaker girls, dressed drab as sparrows, but lively of wit and fair of face, and they made a pet of Ian, vying with each other to offer him small beer and meat pies when he came. A good deal better the lad should spend his time flirting with virtuous Quakers than with the bold-eyed Indian lassies over the ridge, he thought, with a little grimness. He hadn't forgotten what Myers had said about Indian women taking men to their beds as they liked. He had sent the wee bondmaid with Ian as well, thinking the brisk fall air might bring a bit of colour to the lassie's face. The wain was white-skinned as Claire, but with the sickly blue-white cast of skimmed milk. Not Claire's pale glow, rich and grainless as the silk-white heartwood of a poplar tree. The log was nearly split. One more blow and a twist of the axe, and 2 good chunks lay ready for the hearth, smelling clean and sharp with resin. He stacked them neatly on the growing woodpile next to the pantry and rolled another half-log into the place beneath his foot. The truth of it was that he liked chopping wood. quite different from the damp, back-breaking, foot-freezing job of cutting peats, but with that same feeling of soul-deep satisfaction at seeing a good stock of fuel laid by, which only those who have spent winters shivering in thin clothes can know. The woodpile reached nearly to the eaves of the house by now. Dry, split chunks of pine and oak, hickory and maple, the sight of them warming his heart as much as the wood itself would warm his flesh. Speaking of warmth, it was a warm day for late October, and his shirt was clinging to his shoulders already. He wiped a sleeve across his face and examined the damp patch critically. If he got wringing, Brianna would insist on washing it again, protest as he might that sweat was clean enough. "Phew!" she would say, with a disapproving nostril flare, wrinkling her long nose up like a possum. He had laughed out loud when he first saw her do it, as much from surprise as from amusement. His mother had died long ago, in his childhood, and while the odd memory of her came now and then in dreams, he had mostly replaced her presence with static pictures, frozen images in his mind. But she had said phew to him when he came in mucky and wrinkled up her long nose in just that way. It had come back with a flash when he saw Brianna do it. What a mystery blood was. How did a tiny gesture, a tone of voice, endure through generations like the harder verities of flesh? He had seen it again and again, watching his nieces and nephews grow, and accepted without thought the echoes of parent and grandparent that appeared for brief moments. The shadow of a face looking back through the years, that vanished again into the face that was now. Yet, now that he saw it in Brianna, he could watch her for hours, he thought, and was reminded of his sister bending close over each of her newborn bairns in fascination. Perhaps that was why parents watched their wains in such enchantment, he thought, finding out all the tiny links between them that bound the chains of life, one generation to the next. He shrugged and pulled the shirt off. It was his own place, after all. There was no one to see the marks on his back, and no one whose business it would be to care if they did. The air was chill and sudden on his damp skin, but a few swings of the axe brought the warm blood pulsing back again. He loved all Jenny's children deeply, especially Ian, the wee gowk whose mixture of foolishness and pig-headed courage reminded him so much of himself at that age. They were his blood, after all. But Brianna... Brianna was his blood and his flesh as well. An unspoken promise kept to his own parents. His gift to Claire and hers to him. Not for the first time he found himself wondering about Frank Randall. And what had Randall thought, holding the child of another man, and a man he had no cause to love. Perhaps Randall had been the better man come to that, to harbour a child for her mother's sake and not his own, to search her face with joy only in its beauty, and not because he saw himself reflected there. He felt vaguely ashamed, and struck down with greater force to exercise the feeling. His mind was concerned entirely with its thoughts, and not at all with his actions. While he used it, though, the axe was as much a part of his body as the arms that swung it. Just as a twinge in wrist or elbow would have warned him instantly of damage, some faint vibration, some subtle shift in weight, arrested him in mid-swing, so that the loosened axe head flew harmlessly across the clearing, rather than slamming into his vulnerable foot. "Dio gratias," he muttered, with rather less thankfulness than the words indicated. He crossed himself perfunctorily and went to pick up the slab of metal. Damn the dry weather! It hadn't rained in nearly a month, and the shrunken haft of his axe was less worrying than the drooping heads of the plants in Claire's garden near the house. He cast a glance at the half-dug well, shrugging in irritation. Another thing that must be done, which there wasn't time to do. It would have to wait a bit. They could haul water from the creek or melt snow, but without wood to burn, they would starve or freeze or both. The door opened and Claire came out, cloak on against the chill of autumn shadows, her basket over her arm. Brianna was behind her, and at sight of them he forgot his annoyance. "What have you done?" Claire said at once, seeing him with the axe head in one hand. Her eyes flicked over him quickly, looking for blood.
"Nay, I'm whole," he assured her. "It's only I've got to mend the handle. You'll be foraging?"
He nodded at Claire's basket.
"I thought we'd try up the stream for wood ears."
"Ah, dinna go too far, eh? There are Indians hunting the far mountain. I smelt them on the ridge this morning."
"You smelled them?"
Brianna asked. One red brow went up in inquiry. He saw Claire glance from Brianna to him and smile slightly to herself.
It was one of his own gestures, then.
He lifted one brow, looking at Claire, and saw her smile grow wider.
"It's autumn, and they're drying venison," he explained to Brianna. "You can smell the smoking fire as a great wheeze away if the wind sets right."
"We won't go far," Claire assured him. "Just above the trout pool."
"Aye, well, I dare say it's safe enough."
He felt some reluctance at letting the women go, but he could scarcely keep them mewed up in the house only because there were savages nearby. The Indians were no doubt peacefully employed, as he was himself, in making winter preparations. If he knew for sure it was Nacognowito's folk, he wouldn't worry. But as it was, the hunting parties often roamed far afield, and it could easily be Cherokee or the odd small tribe that called themselves the Dog People. There was only one village of them left, and they were deeply suspicious of white strangers. Not without reason. Brianna's eyes rested on his bare chest for a moment, at the tiny knot of puckered scar tissue, but she showed no sign of disgust or curiosity. Nor did she, when she laid her hand briefly on his shoulder, kissing his cheek in goodbye, though he knew she must feel the healed welts beneath her fingers.
Claire would have told her, he supposed, all about Jack Randall and the days before the rising.
Or perhaps not quite all. A small shiver that had nothing to do with the cold ran up the crease of his spine, and he stepped back, away from her touch, though he still smiled at her.
"There's bread in the hutch and a little stew left in the kettle for you and Ian and Lizzie."
Claire reached up and flicked a stray wood chip from his hair.
"Don't eat the pudding in the pantry. That's for supper."
He caught her fingers in his and kissed her knuckles lightly. She looked surprised, and then a faint warm glow came up under her skin. She came up a tiptoe and kissed his mouth, then hurried after Brianna, already at the edge of the clearing.
"Be careful," he called after them.
They waved and disappeared into the woods, leaving him with their kisses soft on his face.
"Dio gratias,"
he murmured again, watching them, and this time spoke with heartfelt gratitude. He waited until the last flicker of Brianna's cloak had vanished, before returning to his work. He sat on the chopping block, a handful of square-headed nails on the ground beside him, carefully driving them one at a time into the end of the axe handle with a small mallet. The dry wood split and spread, but held by the iron enclosure of the axe head, couldn't splinter. He twisted the head, then finding it firm, stood up and brought the axe down in a mighty blow on the chopping block by way of test. It held. He was chilled now from sitting and pulled his shirt back on. He was hungry too, but he would wait a bit for the young ones. Not but what they had likely stuffed themselves already, he thought cynically. He could almost smell the meat pies Sarah Woolham made, the rich scent twining in his memory through the actual autumn smells of dead leaves and damp earth. The thought of meat pies lingered in his mind as he went on with his work, along with the thought of winter.
The Indians said it would be hard this winter, not like the last.
How would it be hunting in deep snow?
It snowed in Scotland, of course, but often enough it lay light on the ground, and the trodden paths of the red deer showed black on the steep, bare mountainsides. Last winter had been like that, but this wilderness was given to extremes. He had heard stories of snowfalls that lay 6 feet deep, valleys where a man might sink to his oxters, and ice that froze so thick on the creeks that a bear could walk across.
He smiled a little grimly, thinking of bears.
Well, and that would be eating for the whole winter if he could kill another. And the skin wouldn't come amiss, either.
His thoughts drifted slowly into the rhythm of his work, one part of his mind dimly occupied with the words to "Daddy's Gone A-Hunting," while the other was taken up with an intriguingly vivid picture of Claire's white skin, pale and intoxicant as Rhenish wine against the glossy black of a bearskin.
"Daddy's gone to fetch a skin to wrap his baby bunting in," he murmured tunelessly under his breath.
He wondered just how much Claire had told Brianna. It was odd, though pleasant, their three-cornered way of talking. He and the lassie were a bit shy yet with each other, inclined to say personal things to Claire instead, confident that she would pass on their essence, their interpreter in this new and awkward language of the heart. Thankful though he was for the miracle of his daughter, he wanted to make love to his wife in his bed again. It was getting over chilly to be having at it in the herb shed or the forest, though he would admit that floundering naked in the huge drifts of yellow chestnut leaves had a certain charm, even if it lacked dignity.
"I will," he muttered, smiling slightly to himself. "And when did a man ever worry for his dignity doing that?"
He glanced thoughtfully at the pile of long, straight pine logs that lay at the side of the clearing, then at the sun.
If Ian was quick enough returning, they might shape and notch a dozen or so before sunset.
Setting down the axe for a moment, he crossed to the house and began to pace out the dimensions of the new room he planned to make do while the big house was a building. She was a grown woman, Brianna. She should have a wee place of her own, to be private in, she and the maid. And if that restored his own privacy with Claire, well, so much the better, eh? He heard the small crackling noises among the dried leaves in the yard, but didn't turn round. There was a tiny cough behind him, like a squirrel sneezing.
"Mrs. Lizzie," he said, eyes still on the ground. "And did you enjoy your ride? I trust you found all the wollums well."
Where was Ian and the wagon, he wondered. He hadn't heard it on the road below. She didn't speak, but made an inarticulate noise that made him swing round in surprise to look at her. She was pale and pinch-faced, and looked like a scared white mouse.
This wasn't unusual.
He knew he frightened her with his size and deep voice, and so he spoke gently to her, slowly, as he would have done to a mistreated dog.
"Have you had an accident, lass? Has something come amiss with the wagon or the horses?"
She shook her head, still wordless. Her eyes were nearly round, grey as the hem of her washed-out gown, and the tip of her nose had gone bright pink.
"Is Ian all right?"
He didn't want to upset her further, but she was beginning to alarm him. Something had happened, that was sure.
"I'm fine, Uncle. So are the horses."
Quiet as an Indian, Ian appeared round the corner of the cabin. He moved to Lizzie's side, offering her the support of his presence, and she took his arm as though by reflex. He glanced from one to the other. Ian was outwardly calm, but his inner agitation was plain to see.
"What's happened?"
he asked, more sharply than he'd intended. The lassie flinched.
"You'd better tell him," Ian said. "There might not be much time."
He touched her shoulder in encouragement, and she seemed to take strength from his hand. She stood up straighter and bobbed her head.
I saw a man at the mill, sir."
She tried to speak further, but her nerve had dried up. The tip of her tongue protruded between her teeth with effort, but no words came out.
"She kent him, Uncle," Ian said.
He looked disturbed, but not afraid. Excited, rather, in an unfamiliar way.
"She'd seen him before, with Brianna."
"Aye."
He tried to speak encouragingly, but the hair on the back of his neck was rising with premonition.
"At Wilmington," Lizzie got out. "Mackenzie was his name. I heard the sailor call him so."
Jamie glanced quickly at Ian, who shook his head.
"He didna give his place, but I didna ken any from Leoch like him. I saw him and heard him speak. He's maybe a Highlander, but schooled in the south, I'd say. An educated man."
"And did this Mr. Mackenzie seem to know my daughter?" he asked.
Lizzie nodded, frowning in concentration.
"Why, sir, she kent him too. She was afraid of him."
"Afraid? Why?"
He spoke sharply, and she blanched. But she was well started now, and the words came out, tripping and stumbling, but still coming.
"I dinna ken, sir. But she turned white when she saw him, sir, and let out a wee skelloch. Then she went red and white and red again. Oh, she was fair upset. Anyone could see it."
"What did he do?"
Why, nothing then. He came close to her and held her by the arms and said to her that she must come awa' with him. Everyone in the tap room was looking. She pulled herself away, white as my shift. But she said to me as it was all right. I was to wait and she would come back, and then she went out with him.
Lizzie drew in a quick breath and wiped the end of her nose, which had begun to drip.
"And you let her go?"
The little bondmaid shrank back, cowering.
"Oh, I should have gone after her. I ken weel, I should, sir," she cried, face twisted with misery. "But I was afraid, sir. May God forgive me."
With an effort, Jamie smoothed the frown from his face and spoke as patiently as he might.
"Aye, well, and what happened then?"
"Oh, I went upstairs as she told me, and I lay in the bed, sir, praying for all I was worth."
"Well, that was very helpful, I'm sure. Uncle."
Ian's voice was soft, but not at all tentative, and his brown eyes were steady on Jamie's.
"She's no but a wee lassie, Uncle. She did her best."
Jamie rubbed his hand hard over his scalp.
"Aye," he said. "I am sorry, lass. I didn't mean to bite your head off. But will you no get on wi' it?"
A hot pink spot had begun to burn on each of Lizzie's cheeks.
She didn't come back till nearly dawn, and...
Jamie had very little patience left, and no doubt it showed on his face.
"I could smell him on her," she whispered,
voice dropping almost to inaudibility.
"His seed?"
The surge of rage took him unaware, like a white-hot bolt of lightning through chest and belly. He felt half-choked with it, but clamped it down tight, hoarding it like coals in a hearth.
"He bedded her, then. You're sure of that?"
Thoroughly mortified at this bluntness, the little bondmaid could do no more than nod. Lizzie was twisting her hands in the stuff of her gown, leaving her skirt all bunched and crumpled. Her paleness was replaced with a hot flush. She looked like one of Claire's tomatoes. She couldn't look at him, but hung her head, staring at the ground.
"Oh, sir, she's with child, can you not see? It must be him. She was virgin when he took her. He's come after her, and she's afraid of him."
Quite suddenly, he could see it, and felt the hairs rise all up his arms and shoulders. The autumn breeze struck cold through shirt and skin, and the rage turned to sickness. All the small things he had half seen and half thought, not allowing them to rise to the surface of his mind, came together at once in a logical pattern. The look of her, and the way she acted, one moment lively and another lost in troubled thought, and the glow in her face that wasn't all from the sun. He knew the look of a woman breeding well enough. If he had known her before, he would have seen the change. But as it was... Claire. Claire knew. The thought came to him, cold in its certainty. She knew her daughter, and she was a physician. She must know, and hadn't told him.
"Are you sure of this?"
The coldness froze his rage. He could feel it stuck in his chest, a dangerous, jagged object that seemed to point in every direction. Lizzie nodded, wordless, and blushed deeper, if such a thing were possible.
"I'm her maid, sir," she whispered, eyes on the ground.
"She means Brianna hasn't had her courses in 2 months,"
Ian provided matter-of-factly. The youngest of a family containing several older sisters, he was not constrained by Lizzie's delicacy.
"She's sure?"
I wouldn't have said anything at all, sir," the girl went on wretchedly. "Only when I saw the man..."
"Do you think he's come to claim her, Uncle?"
Ian interrupted.
"We must stop him, aye?"
The look of angry excitement was clear now, flushing the lad's lean cheeks with feeling. Jamie took a deep breath, only then realizing that he'd been holding it.
"I dinna ken," he said,
surprised at the calmness of his own tone. He had barely had time to take in the news, let alone to draw conclusions. But the lad was right. There was a danger to be dealt with. If this Mackenzie wished it, he might claim Brianna as his wife by right of common law, with the coming bairn as evidence of his claim. A court of law wouldn't necessarily force a woman to wed a rapist,